So I kind of think I'm talking about Buddha nature, which makes sense. That's what we're studying on Sunday evening. And in the Sunday tea group, we've been looking at the eight winds of the world, pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disgrace. We've had this drawing, I don't know if you can see it very well, but it's kind of generated quite a bit of conversation, this simple little drawing. It's of a Zabuton with a Zafu, and then the winds, the eight winds of the world blowing. So four of those winds we sort of think of as good, and four we think of as not so good, but all of them are transient. The pleasure inevitably leads to some sort of pain, and the gain inevitably leads to some sort of loss. So they all buffer us. They all blow against us, and they all pass. So this drawing, some of the things that were noted about it is that if it had just been a Zabuton with a Zafu and a person sitting on it, that would have felt a little too solid, as if, you know, there really is someone that does experience gain and loss and pleasure and pain and fame and disgrace. So that would have been too much. But if it had just been a Zabuton without a Zafu on it, then that might have been not enough. That would have been maybe as if there is just really no one, and there is no real pain, and we kind of know just from experience that that's also not quite right too. So having the Zafu just was like, we do have bottoms that sit on these Zafus, but at the same time the winds can just blow right through us and not knock us around too much. So this, it seems that this picture in a way can kind of represent that sense of our deep knowing of our true nature being not this discrete separate thing, but this something much, much larger that nothing can really knock over. It says holding our seat. Holding our seat. That's, we sort of talked about the eight winds: pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disgrace. We talked about them, the actual experience of those, but in some ways, more importantly, how do we hold our seat when they happen? Because we kind of know them all very well anyway. We know those very well. So how do we hold our seat when all of that's happening, you know? And just today I got in my email, I get this weekly thing from Pema Chodron, heart advice. I don't know if anyone else gets it. It's just free from Shambhala. So this one, it's kind of like this holding your seat. She calls it being steady as a log. And she says, emotional turmoil begins with an initial perception, a sight, sound, thought, which gives rise to a feeling of comfort or discomfort. This is the subtlest stage of getting hooked. Energetically, there is a perceptible pull. It's like wanting to scratch an itch. We don't have to be advanced meditators to catch this. This initial tug of for or against is the first place we can remain as steady as a log. Just experience the tug and relax into the restlessness of the energy without fanning this ember with thoughts. If we stay present with the rawness of our direct experience, emotional energy can move through us without getting stuck. Of course, this isn't easy and it takes practice. So Something that was mentioned on Sunday was about one of the first koans, Mu, that a lot of people study. And I was thinking about how that case, a monk asked Zhao Zhou, has a dog Buddha nature or not? Zhao Zhou says, Mu. So Zhao Zhou says, no, or has not. And I was thinking about how, what it was like when I was working really strongly with that case and really contemplating, no, has not. And just walking around day after day, no, has not. And it was really interesting how this kind of no opened up a really, really wide sort of yes. Really wide yes. And for some reason I've got some relationship with gas stations. I always think of them when I think of this case. I mentioned it, I think, in my last talk about gas stations. And I think it might be because we drive and then we stop. We're putting gas in the car. We've got this period of time of just being like something. We've got this time, however many, like minutes. And it's just a really good contemplative opportunity when instead of just looking at, oh, look at the price, it's gone up this week, tick, tick, tick. Instead of doing that, we can be going, no. Or the other sort of side of that is everything, you know, everything is this one thing, even this gas station. And there's the gas station I go to, Walnut and Mission, is actually owned by a Vietnamese couple who are Buddhists. And inside, just next to where the ice cream freezer is, they have a little shrine. I just enjoy seeing that shrine with a golden Buddha. And well, there's always a fruit offering and incense. It's not always burning because they're not always there, but. So nothing separate, no separate thing, myself or the gas station, you know, no separation of any of these things. And in some Zen centers, that first koan is recited always on the first day of Sesshin, and there's women's comment that goes with it, which I thought I would read because it's very sort of... it's inspirational, it's like really encourages strong practice. And you can replace the word mu with, you know, no self or impermanence or interpenetration. Really, just, you know, which word works for you or which kind of. Wherever you're working, you can put that word into this. So as I'm reading it, you don't have to think about mu. You could think about something else. For the practice of Zen, it is imperative that you pass through the barrier set up by the ancestral teachers. For subtle realization, it is of the utmost importance that you cut off the mind road. If you do not pass the barrier of the ancestors, if you do not cut off the mind road, then you are a ghost clinging to bushes and grasses. What is the barrier of the ancestral teachers? It is just this one word, mu, the one barrier of our faith. We call it the gateless barrier of the Zen tradition. When you pass through this barrier, you will not only interview Zhao Zhou intimately, you will walk hand in hand with all the ancestral teachers in the successive generations of our lineage, the hair of your eyebrows entangled with theirs, seeing with the same eyes, hearing with the same ears. Won't that be fulfilling? Is there anyone who would not want to pass this barrier? So then, make your whole body a mass of doubt, and with your 360 bones and joints and your 84,000 hair follicles, concentrate on this one word, mu. Day and night, keep digging into it. Don't consider it to be nothingness, don't think of has and has not. It is like swallowing a red hot iron ball. You try to vomit it out, but you can't. Gradually, you purify yourself, eliminating mistaken knowledge and attitudes that you have held from the past. Inside and outside become one. You're like a mute person who has had a dream. You know it for yourself alone. Suddenly, Mu breaks open. The heavens are astonished. The earth is shaken. It is as though you have snatched the great sword of General Khan. When you meet the Buddha, you kill the Buddha. When you meet Bodhidharma, you kill Bodhidharma. At the very cliff edge of birth and death, you find the great freedom. In the six worlds and the four modes of birth, you enjoy a samadhi of frolic and play. How then should you work with it? Exhaust all your life energy on this one word, Mu. If you do not falter, then it's done. A single spark lights your Dharma candle. So I've heard that repeated, first day of Sesshin many times, and the words would just sink in and be very motivating, Because I think practice can be really painful. It can be very hard to change habits of mind. And it does can feel like that, like a hot iron ball that you can't vomit up. I mean, it can just be very, very painful. And kind of on a personal aspect of this koan, you could say that the monk is asking, well, do I have Buddha nature? The monk maybe wouldn't quite feel safe enough to say that, so he says, does a dog, those wretched things that are barking and covered in dust, and do they have Buddha nature? But really, maybe he is asking, do I have Buddha nature? Could that be possible? And I think actually most of us, maybe some people not, I know I do, somehow, even though it's not really logical, think maybe we're an exception. Maybe we're the one that doesn't have Buddha nature or is in Buddha nature, because it's not like it's something that we have, it's something that we all are. But I think sometimes we do, many people I know express that maybe just somehow I'm an exception to that, and somehow I didn't quite get to be included, and I don't. But I think even when we think that, there's a deeper knowing that I think everybody has, which maybe is why we're so restless, that we know somehow our birthright is to be at ease and to be intimate. We sort of know it. We know it somewhere inside. It's not happening. Not happening all the time. And so there's a kind of like a searching, a restlessness to try and find that peace, to find that place that we actually do know is our birthright and do know that that's really who we are. I think even people who are doing terrible things, even in the terrible things that they're doing, they're actually just unskillfully trying to find peace. They're still actually just in a misguided way trying to find that ease that they somehow know is their birthright. They're just not necessarily going about it a very good way. I think it's that sense that makes it hard for me to hate anyone, I think it's very hard to hate someone when you sense that somehow they know that they deserve better or that they are better than what they're being. And they're trying, and they're shooting missiles, and they're trying. but they're not actually really trying to harm themselves. I don't think anybody's really trying to harm themselves because they know that they're Buddhas. In whatever words they call it. In some case, I didn't take the time to look for it, but there's some case somewhere about asking the question, where is my nature? Where is my Buddha nature? And, you know, like common sort of thing to sort of like, where is it? Is it under the Sabutang? The Myrakasu? Where is my Buddha nature? And is it going to be after I've been meditating for a year, or is it going to be when something happens and I'm a better person? But the Buddha nature is just right there in that very act of, where is it? Is it under here? Where is it? Right there it is, just all of us being here on a Wednesday evening. So the other case that I thought about is right at the other end, traditionally, of the koan curriculum, the five ranks of Tung Shan. And the last one is not falling into being and non-being. Who can accord with this? Everyone longs to leave the eternal flux. Not just to live in harmony, but to return and sit by the charcoal fire. So everyone longs to leave the eternal flux. Not just to live in harmony, but to return and sit by the charcoal fire. I think this is just a very beautiful image of, you know, we're in this flux, like with our drawing. The winds are blowing and things are happening. People are getting older and sometimes people's lives are accumulating in status or in possessions, and that makes the fall possibly more precarious, you know. So that's all this flux, you know. All this flux is occurring. I think we all long to leave and sit by the charcoal fire. I remember my teacher sort of, as I was resting this idea of being at ease by the charcoal fire, you know, dark with the fire and everyone around in my place. Just in the whole Buddha nature. He sort of said, don't forget that the charcoal fireplace is just the market. The charcoal fire is just the marketplace. Got to get up and go about your business. So there were a few other things that quotes that we talked about a little bit in the tea group, but I think I'd like to sort of see if there was conversation that wants to be had for a bit, and read them if we run out of things to say. So if anyone has anything they'd like to ask or comment on.
So I've always been, I've only heard it a few times, but I've been very perplexed by the saying, to kill the Buddha, if you meet him, to kill the Bodhisattva. Perhaps that's something one contemplates for quite a long time. But
yeah. Well, I don't know if you noticed, but I said the word kill quite gently. I didn't say kill the Buddha. I did that on purpose, like Let's just ease into that a little bit. Let's just kill the Buddha. Kill Bodhidharma. You don't have to kill the Buddha. You don't have to do it like that. You can be like, what could this be about? What could this be about? Kill the Buddha. Did you have some thoughts on what it could be pointing to?
Maybe it's the last thing one encounters before enlightenment, and it's the last kind of duality or something.
That's a good answer. You know, this whole practice is about intimacy. You know, the whole practice is about intimacy. So I think that, you know, the idea of to not see anything as really distant. So in that sense, kill the Buddha, kill Bodhidharma. So they're just all right here in our own bellies. That might be what it's pointing to. I'm not really sure either. So that's what I take from it. I think of it that way. It's like, it's not over there. It's not over there.
In practice over 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 years of practice, and that sense of intimacy really does develop over a generation, over many decades. And lately I've just been thinking about my mind when I'm with them, and how close I am to that mind, how it just can settle in. It's not exactly the charcoal fire a lot of the time, but I just know that my mind with my family, because it's something we've practiced, you know, now over 6 decades. Thinking about intimacy as I anticipate the meal tomorrow. But it's a lot like just sitting. It's a lot like just looking at that mind.
Wouldn't it be nice to have that level of comfortability in general, you know. Because I know that feeling. I'm going to go to Australia for 2 weeks, and as soon as I'm there, it's just like, ah. Oh. And I just am very fluid. It's just everything, conversations just roll along, and jokes just happen, and everyone gets them, and it just, like, it all just flows.
And it's not always great, but there's a confidence that, you know, of having practiced, knowing the ropes, or practicing the ropes.
Mm.
And there's a certain freedom, as you're describing.
I was thinking about working with no and has not, and no separation. That when we feel conflictual and we kind of break into two, like me and them, it's kind of amusing if we do it to ourselves or if someone else were to do it to us. When we're in the midst of that, but they, something, 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 to say, well, maybe that's not quite so. Or maybe they're not actually that different from you. It's like, don't say that right now. Right now I need them to be sort of my adversary right now, so I can blame and so on. So that's when the no opens everything up, you know, just expands everything and includes everything.
Thanksgiving, and I didn't want to take the opportunity to say how honored and how comfortable and how happy I am to be in this company. And what keeps occurring to me, I'm a musician, and it feels like we're having a jam session. All of us, you know, and it's such a respectful and combined poetic and metaphoric and musical coming together that we have, and I'm back after a long time of not being, and I'm really, really happy to be among all of you. It's a great honor to me.
It's a bit like we're one big ball of Buddha nature soup. Not separate from all the other bowls of Buddha nature soup.
It occurs to me there's a silent way of saying no. Silent both in terms of the mouth and the brain. And that is simply to pause.
They know it from self alone.
And the confidence that the practice does open up our life. And as we reminded of that, I do certainly feel that in Sesshin, that kind of deep confidence. And sometimes I felt like maybe the gift of practice is knowing myself really well, but I think it's maybe more just maybe intimacy with some part of the universe that's just kind of beyond words. Or, and then it, yeah. Anyway.
We've got just a couple more minutes if anyone else would like to contribute something.
A long time ago, a good friend of mine was telling me about, you know, if you meet Buddha on the road, kill him. And I was wondering what that meant, but it seems like it's in a sense that when I meet Nettie, I should want to kill Nettie, or I want to kill Rob, in the sense of killing that separateness, mm-hmm. that sense of thinking, this is what I think Rob is, so I'm going to kill that. I want to stop that metaphorically. I'm not coming in preconceived notions, mm-hmm. that really not two, we are one. And so when I meet you, that, to me, that's the metaphorical killing. Mm. It's to just cut off any assumptions, maybe, and try to not be separate.
Yeah. And then when you do that, then you're completely free to say, Michael. You know, then the preconceptions are then dropped away, and you can then you can re-say that again with a whole lightness to it. You can say, Nettie. With a new sort of lightness, because the conceptual aspect, the sort of separate, non-intimate, has been dropped away. Yeah.
And it's very easy to try to kill somebody else. Very hard to try to kill somebody else, because you have these conceptions, you have to do it again and again, because they arise.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, like even just coming to do this talk, I had to remind myself, this is just all of me. This is just Buddha nature. This is me. I'm talking about it, so I might as well try and not feel a separation between myself and other when I come in here, you know. So I was a little nervous a few hours ago. I was like, that's just delusional to be nervous about that. I mean, it's fine, you're nervous. That's also part of it, but... I don't need to bother doing that, because, you know, we're just this one thing. So what would it matter what happens, really? Okay. Well, thank you. I'd like to dedicate any merit that comes from our sharing to the suffering that is happening in the Middle East, and hope that it just quietens down there. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are countless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.